personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Guest today has written a very good book entitled Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It, published by Ignatius very recently. Her name is Jennifer Fulweiler. She lives in Austin, Texas. She is a programmer turned writer who has been keeping a very popular blog on faith and family life called ConversionDiary.com. She's written a lot of articles. They've been in America, our Sunday Visitor, Envoy, National Review Online. She's been on a lot of TV shows, including Fox and Friends, EWTN's Life on the Rock, and there was a three-episode reality show called Minor Revisions that was broadcast on NET. She and her husband, Joe, live in Austin. They have six kids. Welcome to Church and Culture, Jennifer.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Jennifer, we've met, and we sat down and had coffee one day years ago, and I remember what a pleasant person you are. Now that I've read your book, I'm surprised you're smiling. I want to tell our listeners that this book, Something Other Than God, that you've written, really is worth reading it. It's not just a good book. It's a memorable book. It's very well written, which is, frankly, rare these days. It's a story. It's a narrative of your... It's not just a conversion story. It's like a conversions story. You show how you go step by step, closer and closer, away from atheism. This happens, that happens, you read this book, you have that experience, you have this conversation. But it's absorbing. And I'll tell you this, the deposition scene, that's got to go into some movie somewhere. That deposition scene is fantastic. So I want to commend you, Jennifer Fulweiler, for writing a book worth reading. It's published by Ignatius Press. It's well presented and absorbing, and it deserves a large audience.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I think maybe the best compliment I have received so far is what you just said, that it's memorable. I think that that's what every author aspires to, and so that's very touching to me. That
it's memorable because it's good, by the way.
Well, you know, I will admit, and this is kind of an interesting lesson to other writers, is the first five drafts I turned in were not well written, but I had this literary agent who, he is not religious himself, and so he said, you can say all your religious craziness in this book, but it has to be of the highest quality, or I will not represent it. And so I worked for 5 years on this thing, and he kept kicking it back, and he set me up to work with experts and to learn. And so, you know, it didn't just happen overnight. I mean, I worked really hard, and I got a lot of feedback to make it something that would be just a pleasure to read, even if you don't happen to have an interest in, you know, religious
communities. It is a pleasure to read. And by the way, I'm so glad you said that on air. People think writing a book is wake up one morning, I'll write a novel, wake up one morning, I'll write a book about God or something.
Right.
Good books are hard bursts.
Yes.
And I spent me 10 years to write one of my books, the one on the history of the idea of happiness, but I loved it. And it sounds to me like you were very absorbed in the process, not only of learning how to write well, but how to present a narrative that a total stranger could take in and understand.
That was exactly my goal all along, because that's very perceptive of you to pick up on that, because I remember when I was still an atheist, but in the beginning stages of looking around and seeing what I could find, I was very interested in books, because one thing about conversions, as you know, I know other converts can probably relate, is we converts tend to be secretive about it at first, especially Catholicism. You know, everybody hates the Catholic Church in this culture, you know. So,
right.
So there was this feeling of I need books, because I wasn't ready to start going to Mass. I wasn't ready to start talking to people. But there wasn't anything that really grabbed me. Or I guess there were a few things, but they were more sort of like textbook style books. And I yearned to hear stories, just well-written stories that I could curl up with at night and get into. And,
yeah, Jennifer, may I comment on how I was struck by how in the early stages of your journey, you were very intellectual. You thought you had a kind of Bertrand Russell-ish grasp of atheism. You thought that any kind of religious belief could not be supported reasonably or scientifically.
Right.
And so a lot of your early account or the early part of your journey was kind of just out of your head. Would you agree with that?
Very much so.
And as your story moves along, it gets more and more like a narrative, a story. Your emotions get involved. Your experiences get involved. Your motherhood gets involved. Your being a wife gets involved. Your being a friend to your Mexican, governess gets involved.
She was just a babysitter, yeah.
And it's really very, it seems like your life just expands and your own self-image expands as you got closer and closer to coming into the church.
That is so true. I once read an account of another atheist to Catholic convert. And in his conversion story, there was a line that really hit me so powerfully that I think, you know, really summarizes what happened to me, too. He said, suddenly, I was surrounded by life.
Oh.
Yeah, but before, he was very sort of closed off. I mean, he did have a wife, but he was, in a way, closed off to her, closed off to openness to children, closed off to openness to helping people in need. He was just closed off. And as he got closer to God, new life in every form started coming into his own life, and I think you really see that in my book, too. It starts, like you said, we're very much in my head, and we just expand and expand and expand to draw new people in as I get closer to God.
I'm talking with Jennifer Fulweiler about her very recent book from Ignatius Press, Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It. And I'm going to pay you the highest compliment of all, and I'm going to say, Jennifer, you have not written a pious book.
Well, I hope not.
And what I mean by that.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
This book is real. The voice is real. The journey is real. And people are going to relate to it, even those who I think you want to speak to the most, those who are grappling with faith.
Yes.
That's who you're really going after, because you seem to, as an author, put yourself in the place of somebody, of a viewer looking at you, as a non-believer looking at your story. And as you tell your story, I get the sense of you're making sure that non-believer sticks with you.
Yes, Absolutely. And in fact, the developmental editor, a developmental editor is someone who helps you with the concept. You know, they're not looking for semicolons and stuff, but they tell you, you know, this chapter doesn't make sense, this one doesn't flow. I had the privilege of working with a woman who was an executive in the publishing industry, and she is a very religious Jewish woman and she doesn't really know any Catholics. She's never had a close Catholic friend. And so as I wrote it, I certainly kept an eye towards people who don't share my
That was your perfect
beliefs.
Audience.
Exactly. And so her feedback was invaluable because there were times that now that I am a practicing Catholic, I would slip into Catholic speak, and she would write notes in the margin.
And
like,
she'd slap you around?
Right. Yeah. Good. She'd say, like, this feels like inside baseball to me. I don't know what you've lost me.
Yes, there is no inside baseball in your book.
Right.
That's why I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it because you were real. You weren't a stained glass window with Miklos Rozsa music kind of pouring out the sides, as much as I like Miklos Rozsa. But I was struck by so many episodes. But let's go to that deposition.
Okay.
And I'll just start the story and you finish it. And I want you to expand more on what gripped you as you stood in the parking lot watching the dead leaves around your feet. Okay?
Okay.
Because I remember that image. It was beautifully done. Sort of T.S. Eliot, you know. And so your husband's an attorney. He started a law firm, Joe. It's small and you're struggling to make ends meet. You're living with your mother. He gets a rather significant client, an old man, who's been swindled out of thousands of dollars, and your husband, Joe, has found out that there are lots of other victims. And so a deposition is then scheduled with this guy and his slick lawyer. And Joe takes you in as... not telling anybody you're his wife, but your legal assistant, and you are, I assume, taking notes. And you're doing video even.
Right.
So tell that story to our listeners. It's really, really powerful.
Right. Okay. So what happened was, the old man had nothing left. I call him Mr. Jaworski in the book. Obviously, the details and names changed, but he had... nothing left, and was very elderly, and he didn't even have relatives. This was a man who did not have children. He had nowhere to turn, and this associate of his had left him just destitute, and the associate had used the money to go to Italy and, you know, take cruises, and
I think he used it for prostitutes as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just for everything under the sun, and the worst part of it is that there was nothing left. I mean, we were trying to get back what we could, but we knew that this man had just been just completely taken advantage of. And so we go to this deposition, and the reason we did the deposition is because the other attorney knew that the man was in failing health and was basically, to put it bluntly, waiting for him to die.
Yeah, they're stringing it out.
Exactly. And so, first of all, we had to fight tooth and nail to even get the deposition because the other side was very disinclined to help us. So we're in that room, and something overtook me. It was one of the most intense experiences of my life where I felt something. In a way, it was actually one of my first spiritual experiences because I felt something that could not be explained just from the physical room alone. I felt like my muscles ached, and I felt like I couldn't breathe, and I felt ill. And so I was ready to, you know, meet the evil swindler guy and, you know, really hate him. And what happened was, you know, I knew that this guy was evil. I knew that everything he had done was evil. But as I watched him in the deposition, I realized he has rationalized all of this. He has told himself.
He believes his own lie, you said.
He believes his own lies. And you'll see in the book, for readers, we'll see in the book, that he was so genuine, just his face so innocent as he was like, well, I had to go to Italy. It was for research.
I had to relax.
Yeah, I had to relax. And I ended up feeling so ill. I mean, truly, I believe that I encountered the devil in that room. I mean,
it's interesting that his lawyer was the one who saw you getting ill.
Yes, and his lawyer really delighted in that. His lawyer was, I mean, he had the serpentine eyes. I mean, he was truly like a character out of a movie. And so I ran outside because I just abandoned the video camera. I had to get out of the room. I was so convinced that I had just encountered evil. But like you said, the watching the leaves swirl moment was when I stood outside and I realized that the difference, but you know, to back up, I always thought that I would never get involved with anything evil.
That you were, you call yourself the good person, capital G, capital P.
Exactly. There was an ontological difference between me and the bad people. You know, like when I would think of the Nazis in Germany, they were bad people, capital B, capital P. And I was a good person. And
The ontology was they were one kind of being and you're another.
Exactly. And so, oof, you know, lucky for me, I don't ever have to worry about being involved in evil because I'm a good person and good people don't get involved in evil things. And then when I watched this deposition and I watched this guy, I realized people who do evil all across the world, all throughout history, they have always, always thought of themselves as good people.
And they believe their own story.
What?
They believe their own. They were self-deceived.
Exactly. Even the people involved in, you know, Nazi Germany, they did not wake up in the morning and say, I think I'm going to do something evil today. That sounds great. Nobody has ever said that. The way we do evil is we tell ourselves lies that make it sound like what we're doing is good. And that's what I saw in that deposition. And it was a chilling, chilling moment.
So you see, you know, so one step in your journey was to sort of be faced with the reality of evil, human evil, but also that you could slip into it as well.
Yes, it was a chilling moment. I think that what I said in the book was, I realized that evil had always been closer to me than I thought, that I was always only one good lie away.
So your own self-deceptions were falling away.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that I'll remember that because the same thing happened to me one day. I mean, it happened to me. And it didn't happen to me till I was past 40.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I was past 40 that I really finally admitted, hey, you know what? There are some serious bad guys out there.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's something I should have learned from reading Macbeth, you know, but I didn't. I think I was more interested in Aristotle's ethics about virtue and so forth, and I missed the evil part.
Right.
Now, tell our listeners why that's an important step in your journey.
Well, for one thing, I mean, I think that when you're coming from this perspective that, you know, there might be some evil like in pockets of the world, but it's probably not that bad, and I definitely don't, you know, I don't need to worry about being a part of that. The quest for truth in matters of morality and spirituality is kind of irrelevant because you look at it like, hey, we're all good people, we have nice lives, let's not worry about the God stuff and, you know, about the moral code stuff. And when I had that moment of realizing that I was always just one good lie away from being an evil person myself, suddenly it seemed imperative that I figure out what is true, because the difference between good and evil is the difference between truth and lies.
So you had just learned a truth about yourself. You were beginning to grasp truth, and it began with you. In fact, you open your entire book by quoting C.S. Lewis, who said, certain truths will only come to certain kinds of people.
Right.
And that means there's a certain, you have to attain a certain worthiness to receive a certain insight. Is that fair to say?
Yes. You know, if you're in the wrong disposition, you're not going to hear truth, even if it's right in front of your face.
And so you got humbled.
Exactly. And I would say, to add to what you said a second ago, not only was I, you know, realizing things about myself and you know, beginning to look for truth, but most importantly, I think, after the deposition, I began to see why searching for truth mattered. And I think that was a key step in my conversion, because before then, I didn't really care whether there was objective truth. I didn't see why it was relevant to my life or to anyone else.
You know, I find it remarkable, to go back a little early in the story, that when you first felt challenged, your atheism felt challenged, you started a blog, which basically was a personal blog saying, hey, you didn't even give your full last name, Jennifer F.
Right.
And you started asking for people to comment on your disquietude. How naturally did putting up a blog about that come to you?
Very naturally. Because
you and I are in different generations, I'll tell you right now.
Well, I actually majored in, like, new media web stuff.
Right. I remember you telling me about that when we met for coffee.
Right. That's right. I've forgotten about that. So I had always had websites. I had always been in the mode of have an opinion, immediately go put it online. So honestly, I'm surprised it took me that long to start the blog. But, you know, the interesting thing is, and I talk about this in the book, that I went to atheist forums and I recruited readers based on who could really just demolish the atheist arguments and use reason. And
so you recruited some of the people that like Aquina, who came and spoke on your...
Yeah, and, I said, yeah. You know, you guys...
Aquila, yeah, microphone.
Right, yeah, I said, you guys do a great job addressing atheism. I want you to talk to me. And what's interesting is all of these people that I had identified as being able to demolish atheism, they were all Catholic. And I didn't know it at the time. I just picked them based on their...
But as you look back, you understand why, right?
Oh, yeah. Now it's very clear. And interestingly, the atheist website, the main atheist website that I used to find these people, the owner of that website also ended up converting to Catholicism later.
Really? But
yeah,
it tends to get contagious when it's real.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, and especially when you start throwing around ideas in, you know, no-holds-barred debates and you actually start listening to the answers, you become Catholic pretty quickly after
that. You know, we got 5 minutes left in this segment. Tell our audience how having your first child affected me. Now, a lot of people talk about life changes with their first child, but yours was far from predictable. Yours had a kind of a difference to it. Talk about that.
Well, that was a big moment. So one thing to understand as a backstory is that my dad didn't raise me to be an atheist per se.
But you were baptized Catholic.
I was, right, yeah, but that, you know, I mean, we never...
You found that out later.
...family again. Yeah, that wasn't even really on my radar. But he didn't raise me to be an atheist per se as much as he raised me to seek truth, question assumptions, and really think through what I believe and follow it to its logical conclusions. And so when my first child was born, I held him in my hands, and I was a strict atheist materialist. No spirituality, no... you know, earth goddess, you know, whatever. I mean, I was strictly atheistic. And so I looked at this child and I thought, what a beautiful, randomly evolved set of chemical reactions that it came from nothing and is destined for nothing.
Like the discussion you and Joe first had on the airplane flight to San Francisco.
Exactly, yeah.
He starts ribbing you for not taking seriously his argument how something can come out of nothing.
Exactly. Yes. And so it was that same moment with the baby, realizing I don't think that the love that I feel for this child is confined only to the chemical reactions in my brain. I think that that love has an external source, that it would still exist even if the whole world blew up tomorrow. There is something external about this. And so it really, it was a big blow to my atheism. And it was.
You mean just having a baby was a big blow to your atheism?
Yeah, that moment of looking at my son and just seeing that I don't believe that he is nothing more than the molecules that make up his body.
So in other words, there's more to my son than just myself.
Exactly.
And there's something, some external. In fact, all through your book, you mark the places where you have experiences where you believe your insight or your emotion or your attitude comes from beyond you.
Yes, because that was very noticeable to me.
It was different.
My background. Yes,
it was different, right?
Right. Right.
And that's why you subtitle your book about happiness.
Well, yeah, because as I was, you know, when I set out to write it, I thought it was purely a conversion story. I used to be an atheist, and I became Catholic, and end of story. But as I began to write it, I realized that what was driving me the whole time is that I was searching for happiness even more, but before I even knew that I was searching for God. And so that's why I changed it to that title and that subtitle.
And, of course, along the line, when you started reading the catechism and theology and so forth, you found out that that's exactly what Catholics teach, that human beings naturally desire happiness, and that happiness is to be found ultimately in the vision of God. But there's a kind of happiness in this world that we can have, an imperfect happiness, and that is what you found.
Exactly.
I'm talking to Jennifer Fulweiler from Texas. We've graduated from the same university, go Longhorns. And by the way, my father went to A&M, where you went the first year or so and your family went. And by the way, my great aunt lived on the 16th floor of the Westgate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where we live. That's amazing.
Yeah. I was up there many times. So, when we come back from this message, we're going to talk more with Jennifer Fulweiler about just what kind of happiness she ultimately found. Please stay with us.
The Ugly Duckling. We all know the classic story. But have you ever seen it put to music live on stage? Explorers Homeschool Drama Troupe will perform the musical Honk at the Lydia Mendelson Theater on U of M's campus in Ann Arbor on May 30th at 7 p.m. and May 31st at 2 p.m. and then again at 7 p.m. Tickets are reasonably priced with a $35 family ticket available for families of all sizes. Contact the Michigan Union Ticket Office online at muto.umich.edu or 734-763-8587. Family tickets only available by phone or in person. You'll delight in the adorable ducklings and barnyard animals. Cry for poor ugly. Be thrilled at his transformation, and then you'll be singing the catchy songs on your way home. Bring the whole family for a musical you won't soon forget. Once again, to purchase tickets, contact the Michigan Union Ticket Office online at muto.umich.edu or 734-763-8587. See you there.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
I'm talking with Jennifer Fulweiler from Austin, Texas, about her recent book. It's a conversion story, but much more. It's entitled Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It, from Ignatius. This is not the kind of conversion story you read that just confirms what you already thought. This is a conversion story that will help anyone, whether they're a Christian, a Catholic, or an unbeliever, deepen their faith. You will see things in this book that will help you wherever you are. And I think that is remarkable for a conversion story, Jennifer.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, like we were saying earlier, I really wanted to make it something that would be accessible to people no matter where they are. So I'm, you know, I was really hoping that it would accomplish that.
You know, I don't want to be a tease to our listeners by spending all the time talking about your earlier experiences. You developed a deep vein thrombosis.
Yes.
Which was caught before your second child.
Yeah, I was pregnant with my second child.
Yeah. And this grappling with the danger of it, the expense of it, et cetera, really, that's what really got your soul churning, am I right?
It is, because the deep vein thrombosis was caused by a blood clotting disorder. It's pretty rare, the one that I have, and it's this disorder is exacerbated by pregnancy. And so the doctor said, you have to use contraception. You have to, you know, get sterilized or, you know, whatever, which is kind of a problem for someone
right.
Converting to Catholicism. And
you were,
so it made me...
You signed up for RCIA the night you went to the hospital to have your first child.
I think it was the night that I went to the hospital for the DVT. I went
okay.
to a hospital, but it was for that.
You called RCIA before you went to the hospital.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Because, yeah, I had recently had a revelation that made me realize that this is, you know, where I need to be in the Catholic Church. But the DVT issue, you know, I think a lot of people, when they're exploring religion, they get down to the doctrines of, you know, the you can't do this, you know, can't do that. And they say, why does it matter? You know, if I can encounter God, why is this church bossing me around on, you know, what I can do with, like, contraceptive choices or whatever? And so I came face to face with that because, you know, I was only 29 or 30 at the time, and you have plenty of childbearing years left, and I had to ask, does this matter, the fact that the church is so big on this issue of contraception? Because I have five doctors lined up telling me that I have to use contraception. So that was really one of the things that got me, as you say, churning in a big way.
So tell our listeners how that was resolved and what was your epiphany.
Okay, so I had always been staunchly pro-choice as well, and I had been wrestling with the issue of abortion because my perception was it takes away women's freedom. And during the process of reading about Catholicism, I had become less staunch in my pro-choice views, but I'd become one of the people who said, you know, I wouldn't do that myself.
And then you read that North Dakota report on abortion.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I said I can't speak out, you know, and oppose it. And I was very hung up on this idea that it's, you know, women have to have freedom over their bodies. This is an issue of freedom. So then, meanwhile, I get the DVT. I'm told that I have a very serious clotting disorder. It's exacerbated by pregnancy. I have to use contraception. And it seemed, you know, I had all of these people telling me, just ignore the church. Use contraception. You know, come on. You know, give it a rest. And then also, I had to be on a medication to treat the clot that is an FDA Category X drug. It is very, very, very serious that you not get pregnant while you're on that drug. So that was actually my biggest issue, is that I was on this drug. And so people said you have to at least use contraception for the months that you're on this drug. And I was tempted by that, and I was thinking about that. And then online, I found a message board thread of a woman who was in a similar situation. She was on the same drug, and she said, I'm Catholic, you know, I just don't know about the contraception thing. And all of these people came down on her to say, no, you have to use contraception, you have to use contraception. So she did, and then she came back later and said, my contraception failed, and
mm-hmm.
now I'm pregnant. And those same people who were railing against the church for taking away women's freedom with contraception said, oh, well, I guess you have to have an abortion now.
They immediately assumed abortion, right?
Yeah, immediately assumed abortion and assumed that she had no choice. And what the big, what clicked for me in that moment is I realized that my support for abortion had rested on a contraceptive mentality in which, you know, like all the other young women in my generation, you know, we weren't taught that, that sex creates babies. We were taught that unprotected sex creates babies. And so we, the young women of my generation were told, hey, do you feel like you absolutely cannot have a baby right now? Well, go ahead and engage in the act that creates babies anyway and just kind of hope it works out. And I realized in that moment that, you know, I had so many friends who ended up in abortion clinics because of that message they were told, who felt like they did not have a choice because they had, you know, they had engaged in the sexual activity when, even though they knew that they absolutely could not have a baby, because our society told them that it would be just fine to do that, and it did not end up being just fine. So that was my big epiphany, that I realized that my support for abortion was absolutely hinged on the lies of contraceptive culture.
And that can be connected to this theme that you have throughout your book about where does something come from?
Right.
The fact that something exists means that it's a being must have come from something that already exists.
Right.
And that you are not the first cause of your own life or your own child's life.
That's a great way to put it. I never articulated it that clearly, but yeah, that is exactly what I came to.
I always dip into metaphysics when I'm looking for words. But, you know, and I'm touched by this, that it was, like you say, a kind of ontological conversion, a kind of conversion based upon understanding the most fundamental question of philosophy, and that is, why is there something rather than nothing?
Right.
And it was then the abortion issue that really, you know, pushed your face into it. You know, at that point, it was personal. It wasn't speculative anymore. It wasn't abstract. It was about you, your family, your baby, Joe, your husband.
Yeah, and like we said earlier, you see those circles expanding. You know, more people get drawn in, and like my world just became bigger through my conversion. I became part of a parish family and the church family.
I was very interested in your relationship with your doctor. Tell our listeners a little about that. He begins like the bad guy in the story.
Right.
Take it from there.
Well, I have to say this. I didn't want to write this in the book and embarrass him. He is a hematologist, and in my first appointment, he mentioned that he has a fear of blood. And I said, "You're a hematologist, and you have a fear of blood." And
it's
the funniest moment that I'm having this big medical crisis.
You should have put that in the book.
Well,
that would have been nice.
I've got a hematologist who's afraid of blood. So,
yeah.
he was very, very pushy. That, you know, he had that typical medical mindset of, you know, just take a pill, take the contraception, and then we don't need to worry about this drugs, we don't need to worry about this treatment, and I can just sort of wash my hands of you. You know, I think he was probably, in his defense, he was probably afraid of liability. You know, it would just be easier to get me on all the drugs and get me out of there and not take
any. But then he ended up congratulating you that you were going to become Catholic.
He did, and in fact, I'm still in touch with him. He's still my doctor, and you know, he still doesn't understand why I make the choices I make. But what I found, and this is a good lesson for anyone in a tough medical situation. You know, when I first went to him, he said there is no other choice. That's insane.
That's right.
You know, not to.
He even seemed to get a little angry with you.
He did, yeah. He was very frustrated with me. But as he, you know, it's like with any relationship, as he got to know me as a person, suddenly, whereas I had been told there are no options, suddenly all of these options came to light once he kind of got to know me as a person.
But you had to push him. You had to challenge him.
Right, exactly. And I'm not good at that. I'm not the lawyer in the family, so I'm not good at that.
What was his faith? Did he have a faith? Did you ever find out what his faith was?
I don't think he does. I'm pretty sure he's. I mean, I don't think he's a militant atheist. He, you know, he said he wants to read my book. So.
Oh, good.
He
should. I think he'd recognize a good man there.
Yes.
Who played
a
vital
that way, because I like and respect him, and so I hope he comes across as a good guy.
I'm talking to Jennifer Fulweiler about her book from Ignatius, published recently, called Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It. What I want to say to the listeners is that this is not a girl's book. I think women are going to find it especially interesting and especially meaningful, but I'm a male, in case anybody, easier minded. And I found it very interesting, and I will recommend it to men because it does take the point of view of an observer who is not looking at this as a woman's story, looking at it as a human story. And with a lot of other people involved. Yes, motherhood plays a central role, but the abortion issue comes up for men and women. It's not limited to women. And I congratulate you again on that score of writing a book that I think will appeal to men as well.
Well, thank you. And you know what's interesting is I've sent out there have been some early readers who received advanced copies and stuff, and I've received wonderful, amazing feedback. But what's interesting is the most effusive feedback I have gotten is usually from men. And I don't know whether that's because they were surprised by...
Oh, they just like the picture.
Right, that's right. But, I think that what probably resonates with them is that I really deal in the world of ideas and, sorting out truth and falsehood. And I have a very, sometimes maybe overly linear approach.
Well, you to everything. Some would say it's a masculine trait.
It is, yeah. I've been told that, and it's I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it is definitely how I'm wired. And so I think the way I think about things is more typical to men than it is to women. And so I do hope that men, and I think men will, in fact, find it to be a fairly entertaining read.
I would even recommend it for couples who are going through marriage instruction. One place where I see this book having real impact.
Because it does go into our marriage so much and how our marriage changed through our conversion.
And it also puts marriage in the context of children and in the context of, you went through a period of really, really grappling with money issues, with, Joe's new law practice, with how you were treating your mother. That you discovered one day you were mistreating her. You got angry at Donald, the crying babies, so you just almost lost it.
Yeah.
And I actually did that once with my daughter Hannah, but we won't talk about that. And so it has just so much reality that both men and women can relate to.
I think that's one of the ways in which my background as a blogger, which, doesn't sound like that would help anyone with anything, but I think it actually helped me with this book because blogs are very informal and
yes.
They're very personal, and people want to feel like they know you like you're their next-door neighbor who they have a cup of coffee with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was a good combination in that what I brought to the table was that a very intimate and personal way of writing that you really go into the details of daily life in a blog. And then what my literary agent and the developmental editor brought to the table was mixing in the quality. Blogs aren't necessarily known for being super high-quality forums, not always anyway. Mine certainly wasn't. But working with these experts in the field taught me how to keep the authenticity, keep the informal personal tone, but take it to a higher level that you would expect from a quality book.
Do you have the book with you right now?
I could get it. It's a few steps away here.
Go get it, because I want you to read to our listeners a little passage from your book. We'll give
you
time.
I am going to get it.
I'm going to ask Jennifer Fulweiler to read a passage from the end of her book, just after she has formally entered the Catholic Church with her husband, Joe. And if you recall, the subtitle was about searching for happiness and accidentally finding it. And she has a passage here about coming home after that formal entry into the church. Jennifer, are you back?
I am back. And, yeah, just give me a page.
Page 242. I want you to read from the three dots to the end of 243. 242 to 243. Read that. I arrived home.
Okay. And yet, and interestingly, this is one that got added in the very last minute. This was not originally going to be published. So, okay. I arrived home to a quiet house. Joe had already put the kids to bed. Their cribs were the only furniture assembled in the house. I peeked into our new bedroom and saw Joe asleep in his clothes on the mattress, a drill and box cutter lying beside him on the floor. I crept back downstairs and into the living room, all the walls blank with possibilities. I kept my coat on and stepped out to the back porch. All around me, the world was quiet and shadowy. I remembered a time in my life when I avoided going outside at night. For years after my existential crisis at the creek, the darkness of the night seemed too real, too familiar, as if it had all leaked out of my soul and shrouded the world around me. Even later, when I regained some balance, standing outside alone at 11 o'clock at night would have involved fighting back an avalanche of thoughts that would have buried me if they'd come. Out of habit, I waited for all those familiar sensations of restlessness and fear and discontent to bubble near the surface this time, too. But everything was still. There on the back porch of my suburban home, for the first time in my life, I was aware, without any question, that I was in the presence of God. I had been looking for him so long, but my sins were like a black smoke that filled the air and blotted out the sun, obscuring it so completely that you sometimes wonder if it still exists. Now, the smoke had been blown away. The air was clear. And finally, I could see.
Well, aren't you glad you added that?
I am, and that was other people's feedback. So
that is absolutely gorgeous passage. Reminds me very much of the end of Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales. Have you read that?
I haven't. I need to
go look at the last page, and you'll
okay.
see that there's a very strong sense of Thomas's own awareness of God as he looks out into the night sky.
Wow, I can't wait to read that.
And,
you know, and it was after my first confession, so it was
really
the moment of being free and open to see God.
Did Joe wake up that night?
No, he was exhausted.
He didn't wake up to shake your hand and say, hey, you're sin free.
You know, I don't think so, actually. I mean, we were that tired. You know, we had two kids under two, one on the way, and we were just pretty floored.
How pregnant were you at that point?
I was 4 or 5 months.
And you still weren't out of the woods in terms of your own physical condition?
No, and an interesting postscript is with this last pregnancy, my sixth, you know, because this doctor was working with me, we thought we had my blood clotting disorder under control, that I would take blood thinners and pregnancy was really a little bit high risk, but fine, no big deal. And Joe and I felt, you know, open to having more kids. We felt like that was fine. And in this past pregnancy, number six, I ended up getting bilateral pulmonary embolisms, which means large blood clots.
There's the sequel. There's the sequel right there.
Exactly. It was, and I was on blood thinners when it happened. And to give you an idea of how serious it was, when I was in the ER, this tech who should not have said this said, there was a guy that had the same thing in here a few weeks ago. And I said, oh, yeah, I hope he's okay. And he said, no, he died 15 minutes later. Usually we can't.
That must have sent the old chill through the veins.
It did. And so now it's serious, and now I actually kind of have to listen to my doctors about the pregnancy thing. So, and, of course, the pressure to use contraception.
Well, you've got six kids. Okay, I'll stop there. I'm talking with Jennifer Fulweiler about her recent book, Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It. Now, how long have you been a Catholic now, Jennifer?
Since 2007, so 7-year anniversary coming up.
7 years. I can't help, since I'm now at my 30th year.
Wow.
31st year. which one day you'll be, God willing.
Right, right.
I have to ask you, have you had any surprises in your 7 years in the Catholic Church? Has anything turned out to be different, better, or worse in your experience?
You know, honestly, every day is a surprise, and I don't just say that to get out of the question. I mean, I guess I've been surprised by how exciting life is, because Joe and I used to, you know, take first class flights to Europe on a whim because we felt like it, and we'd go, you know, zip lining in the jungles of South America, and you know, we were always searching for adventure. But that secular type of adventure, it's like going to a theme park. You know, there's no real danger. You've got the handrails and it's all very, very predictable. But it's like I often say when I give talks about my conversion story that it's not so much that my life is better now that I'm Catholic. It's that my life has started now. I feel like I was living this sort of theme park life when I was an atheist, you know, like looking for these thrills and excitement. It was all very flat. But now it's like I'm living this real life that is full of drama and risk and glory and adventure. And it's funny because I used to live downtown and now I live in the burbs. But I guess I've just been surprised by how exciting it is to be a faithful Catholic.
And I'm sure the joy has expanded the more kids come into the home. Am I right?
It has. You know, you might recall from the book that Joe and I are both only children, and so it's all new to us, this whole, you know, big family life. It's absolutely wonderful and crazy.
I've always found that large families are usually, almost invariably, happy families.
You know, we really are. I mean, I have to say it's chaotic, but there is, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. There is so, so much joy in our house. There really is.
Well, that might be your next book. You remember the opening line to Tolstoy's Anna Karenina?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it.
Happy families are all alike.
Right.
And
right.
Unhappy families are different, each in their own way.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
You might start meditating on that for your next book. Now.
Yeah, I should quote that as an opening line.
Well, you know, it's debatable whether all happy families are alike, and but I certainly agree with the thought that that unhappy families usually are unhappy in their own peculiar or particular way. What is the thing that people are saying about your book, those who have read it already? What's the one thing that's being repeated by people who are coming back to you about your book?
You know, the biggest thing that it doesn't exactly speak to details. Everyone tells me that they read it in one sitting.
So did I.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I
did. I was going to tell you that.
I know everyone. I don't think I have heard from someone who read it, but like took a week to do so.
Isn't that the greatest? I mean, you're not. I know you're not bragging on yourself. I'll brag on you. But isn't that the greatest compliment, that people sit down and read a 243-page book in one sitting?
It's so gratifying and just so exciting. And again, truly, the credit goes to these editors I worked with. I mean, if it had just been me on my own, I think you'd still be slogging through it.
No, everybody needs an editor. I mean, Hemingway had an editor. I mean, all good writers had Tolstoy's wife edited for him.
Yep.
And on and on and on. And if anything that I publish, it isn't edited, it has just filled with mistakes, words left out, you know, sentences meaning the opposite of what they should have meant, and so forth. Now, you are, you know, but a lot of new writers will not submit to tough editing.
It's hard. I mean,
but
I
you did.
I actually cried at one point. I was so just embarrassed and frustrated, and it just wounded my pride to get back this manuscript from this top editor who every page was just filled with red, and I thought, you know, this is why people don't do this, because this is hard. This is a huge blow to my ego.
It is. It's like playing
once
golf.
Once you got past it, and I had to step away and just pray about it. But once you got past it, one
that was, I guess,
made it much better.
Just one more lesson in humility, but he sure paid off because, Jennifer Fulweiler, you have written a wonderful book that I strongly recommend for Ignatius, Something Other Than God, How I Passionately Sought Happiness and Accidentally Found It. Jennifer Fulweiler, thank you for being my guest today on Church and Culture.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And we hope that all of you will stick around to meet my next guest after this message.
What is it like to be 16 years old and travel 12 hours on a bus to march for life in sub-freezing temperatures in our nation's capital? This is Peggy Stanton. Tune into Power from the Pews and find out as I interview Monica Von Berkum on Saturday at 1:30 p.m. and Sunday 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
The Ave Maria Radio app is available for all Apple and Android users. Listen to Ave Maria Radio live or listen to your favorite shows whenever you want, on demand. Like what you heard? Post a link on your email, Facebook, or Twitter account in just two taps. You can even leave a voice message on our feedback page. Purchase books or look up references from our hosts and guests, and it's all absolutely free. Just go to the App Store and type Ave. It's just that simple. The Ave Maria Radio app.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Father Ricardo continues with the Alpha 201 series on our next edition of Christ is the Answer. After completing the Alpha course, many parishioners had experienced major changes in their lives and wanted more. Father Ricardo and his pastoral team developed Alpha 201. He continues with it on our next edition, when we'll hear about suffering. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the light. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Most great classroom experiences include rigorous discussion between students and teachers. Today, on Homeschool Heartbeat, your host Mike Smith interviews college sophomore Esther Ehrenman to explore how PHC Prep's online AP courses provided her with excellent discussion in a virtual classroom.
Today, I'm joined by Esther Ehrenman, a college sophomore who took AP classes online from PHC Prep. Welcome, Esther. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thank you.
What was it like for you to be a student in an online AP class, and can you describe the types of things you would do in a typical week during your school year?
Well, people all across the country would meet for something like a virtual Skype session where the professor and the teacher's aide would tell us what the material for the week would be. And then during the rest of the week, we would complete assignments, take a quiz, have online discussion boards. I loved the meeting of the minds because there was this really cool iron sharpens iron effect with my peers, because we all enjoyed rigorous intellectual discussion and we were all pursuing the same academic goals guided by the professors, who not only modeled a thirst for knowledge, but they also were very godly and intellectual people who we could look up to as mentors.
So would you recommend this for any young person that's interested in getting some AP courses?
Oh, definitely. I learned a ton, both in terms of academics and in terms of managing my time and learning how to